Well, good morning, TNC family, from my home to wherever you are. And I want to start here. About 2,000 years ago, a Jewish rabbi named Jesus was walking through the desert with his 12 disciples. He was traveling to Samaria, a region into which most Israelites did not regularly venture. Samaritans were polytheistic. They engaged in what felt like offensive social and ethnic practices. They outright disregarded the Jewish prophets and holy writings. Further, there was a centuries-long history of deep mutual suspicion between the two, including, the historian Josephus tells us, several damaging events like Samaritans harassing Jewish travelers and Samaritans scattering human bones in the Jerusalem sanctuary, and Jews in turn burning down Samaritan villages. Yet, Jesus and his disciples travel there and arrive at a drinking well isolated outside the Samaritan town. And the disciples, they go into town, but Jesus waits by the well. When a lone woman appears at the well with some empty jars or animal skins, two of the options they had for containers for carrying water. And it's noon, the text says, not the time of day people come to get water, unless you're a woman of shame, an outcast in your own community, then you would come in the middle of the day under the scorching sun to avoid an interaction of discrimination and shame from others. But there's Jesus, and here's the woman, and then it happens. John chapter 4 and verse 7 tell us that Jesus asks, "Will you give me a drink?" Which is a shocking question, because at best, at absolute best, you might expect a timid head nod, then look the other way and go about your own business. "Will you give me a drink?" Jesus asks. Verse 9, the Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew and I am a Samaritan woman." Notice she stands at the intersectionality of two discriminatory factors, Samaritan woman. "You are a Jew and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" It's a shocking question. And what's shocking is not that a thirsty human would ask another human for a cup of water. What's shocking is that loaded in this question, loaded is a first century man asking a woman instead of telling her. What's loaded is Jesus knows that a conversation like this risks all kinds of later gossip and innuendo and judgment. And here's a bit of proof. Jump ahead to verse 27. You'll read that when the disciples returned, they were, quote, surprised to find him talking to a woman. And what else is loaded about the question is that Jews would not drink from a Samaritan's jar because doing so would make them ceremonially unclean. No, I'll use my drinking fountain. You use yours. So the question is more than, can I have some H2O? It's a question that conveys a common humanity and trust. It's a question that acknowledges, I see your outward identity, and I'm not bothered or put off by it. I embrace it. And it's a question that acknowledges an inward identity too. I'm opening up a conversation of equals. I respect you, and I approach this encounter with humility and possibility. Which leads me to this. Jesus, like Socrates, 400 years before, was famous for how he used questions to help people see new realities and feel deeper hope and experience learning and growth. Questions. Asking questions, turns out, was one of the main ways Jesus chose to usher in the kingdom of God, to overthrow the forces of evil, and to teach those around him about new ways to do power and money and status, about new ways to overcome brokenness and fear, and about how to discover emotional, physical, psychological, and theological healing. Asking questions. Jesus would ask questions of prostitutes and beggars, criminals, soldiers, politicians, rabbis, lepers, landowners, the elites, and the discriminated against. Do you want to be well? Where are your accusers? Whose picture is on this money? If you love those who love you, what reward is that? Who of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to his or her life? Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? Why are you so afraid? Which is easier, to say your sins are forgiven or to say, get up and walk? What did you go out into the desert to see? How can anyone enter a strong man's house and carry off his possessions unless he first ties up the strong man? Who is my mother and who are my brothers? Why do you ask me about what is good? Which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? Friends, read the biographies, the histories. They're relatively short, and yet in them, Jesus asks over 135 questions. And by the way, Jesus never asks a question because he doesn't know the answer. He used questions the way a surgeon uses a scalpel, the way a painter uses a canvas, the way a composer uses the melody and the countermelody to reach more deeply inside a person, to create a deeper level of understanding. Now, maybe you know this. A few years ago, Gerald Panas and his team were doing research for a book about how to build the most trusted business relationships. Panas had already written 13 books at the time and was CEO of the largest consulting firm in the world for advising nonprofit organizations. And his team flew to Chicago to interview the CEO of a $12 billion company. And they asked, what builds trust and credibility with you early on in our relationship? And the executive answered, quote, I can always tell how good a prospective partner will be by the quality of their questions. Questions build trust. That's how simple it is. And they found a similar theme in interviews across a spectrum of disciplines, which led them to write the book called Power Questions. It's a book all about questions. Nobel Prize winning physicist I.I. Rabi, when asked who is the most important intellectual influence on his life, famously said, my mother. And when he was asked why, Rabi answered, because when I used to come home from school, she would say to me, did you ask any good questions today? And of course, an even more famous physicist, Albert Einstein, if you read what's considered the definitive biography of Einstein by Walter Isaacson, you'll come away really clear on this, that the two most important features of Einstein's personality were curiosity and independent thinking. Isaacson writes about how one day Einstein was watching the sun glittering off a field of flowers, and he asked himself, could I travel on that beam of light? Could I reach or exceed the speed of that light? And if we're moving through a curved space the way a beetle moves across a curved leaf, How would we notice it? You know, normal questions that we all ask ourselves. Einstein later wrote a friend, "I have no special talents. I am only passionately curious. I've learned the important thing is to not stop questioning. Never lose a holy curiosity." Because anytime a person is asking more than answering, you can be pretty certain they may be at the front edge of a discovery or a new relationship or a stronger connection. Now, I'm not saying we don't need answers. I get that we need answers and need to share answers because answers are important. But I am suggesting that better questions need to precede those answers. Better questions, the right questions. N.T. Wright, the leading New Testament scholar alive today, actually talks about this in terms of the scriptures, although this can be applied anywhere. He says, imagine a group of folks who have never seen a neon sign and are suddenly confronted with one. Now, I actually have never been to Vegas, but I know they actually have the largest neon signs in the world. Imagine a group of folks who have never seen a neon sign were suddenly confronted with one, he says. One with huge neon words written in a foreign language. Now, he writes, imagine if the people spent all their time asking how on earth it lights up like that, rather than realizing that the sign is actually saying something and asking about what the sign is actually saying. Wright says, and this is our culture. We're a culture that asks too many questions about the sign instead of what the sign is pointing to. Because listen, TNC, you can ask questions, but they can be the wrong ones. And so for a few minutes now, I want to suggest five questions that I believe are some of the right ones to ask ourselves in this era, in these times that we're living in. Because our temptation in this era is to look at the neon signs, signs that light up on our TV screen and tell us the number of cases or deaths, signs that shine a light on one police encounter or one kind of protest, signs that light up one tweet or that stock market fluctuation or that political jab. Our temptation is to see the light from the signs and to say, hey, did you see that neon sign? But to never ask the more important question, which is, what is that sign saying to us? See, we need better questions. Starting quite honestly, not with questions about why you or why they, but with questions for ourselves. Why me? This is exactly what the psalmist is getting at when he writes in Psalm 119, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me. Know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." And so, I want now to offer you five questions for each of us to ask ourselves in this era that we're living in. Five questions. And here's number one. Question number one. Why do I believe what I believe? And this is an important first question because today more than ever, we know that our beliefs are a result of numerous other forces, people and events outside of our own planning and control. I'm saying there are a lot of factors responsible for the foundations of our beliefs that we did not independently choose. And so if you want to know why you believe what you believe, you should start with things like these. Where were you born? When were you born? The language your parents spoke. the neighborhood they lived in, the church they did or did not attend, the places they went when you were young, the things or ideas they followed, read about, watched on their TV. And it's not just things associated with your parents or your place of birth. It's who moved in next door to you and what school district you went to, because that was the circle where you likely chose your closest friends. And the classroom from which you listened to that teacher. You know, the compelling, loving one who turned out to be your favorite teacher because he or she was in love with the subject and helped you fall in love with that subject, which propelled you towards your preferred career and the college you attended and the job you applied for and the place you applied for it, which created your new social circle and the people who became your friends and your daily conversation companions. All because that teacher was hired by that principal, something you had no control over. I'm saying, friends, it turns out that why you believe what you believe is largely shaped by events and people out of your control. There's a great book by Jonah Berger about this called Invisible Influence. Berger's a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a best-selling author, an expert on social influence, and he makes some great observations, beginning with some actually pretty mundane ones that we totally and intuitively will understand. For example, he says, imagine running on a treadmill by yourself versus having someone else in the room at the same time. Turns out that even if that other person is just reading on their phone, the mere fact that they are there will impact your motivation and lead you to run faster and longer. Interestingly, though, in some other cases, somebody else's presence leads you to perform worse. If you've ever parallel parked with someone else in the car, you've probably noticed it made you a worse parallel parker. They make you nervous. Or imagine you're ordering dinner at a restaurant with a group of friends, and you're planning on ordering the salmon, but before you get the chance, someone else picks the same thing. Turns out, he says, you are now less likely to order the salmon and more likely to pick something else, even though it will make you less satisfied with what you end up eating. Or, fascinating chapter, did you know that political party matters more than policy? If people think a given political idea is supported by their own party, they love the idea. But take that same policy and tell people the other side supports it, and suddenly their opinions completely switch. Now they hate it. Further, listen to this. Did you know that if somebody looks like you and sounds like you and says it like you, your defenses are down and you are more likely to believe it than if someone who doesn't look like you or sound like you says the same thing? Why do I believe what I believe about money or sports or friendships or poverty or with the environment or racism or religion or the Bible or God? See, chances are it has a lot to do with my year and place of birth, my parents, my church, my school district, and my friends, more than my amazing, unbiased genius. Why do I believe what I believe? Which should lead you directly to question number two, the second question to ask yourself in this era. Question number two, am I aware of the planks in my own eyes? This has to do with knowing your inherited biases and therefore knowing your blind spots and therefore knowing your weaknesses, which has to do with being honest about where you might be ignorant, which has to do with humility. I mean, it's so easy to see where others are wrong, isn't it? You should not be so angry. You should not be expressing your anger in that way. Plus, you're way overreacting, and you're taking it way too personally. Me? Oh, I'm handling it, yeah, just about right. They? Oh my, they're setting bad policy. They're letting politics get in the way of progress. They're interpreting events through a lens of their own agenda. They're posting and tweeting things totally off base. But me, I checked out my last 50 posts. Yeah, I'm seeing things pretty straightforward. Friends, we've got to follow the wisdom of Jesus on this, who challenged us to deal with the planks in our own eyes before attempting to remove the specks from the eyes of others. Are you aware of the planks in your own eyes? So, for example, regarding race, something that's been at the forefront of conversation in our country, instead of saying, "Oh, there's not a racist bone in my body. No planks here." And from my wise perspective, racism, you know, it's in the past, except for a few bad apples who act up in periodic public horrific acts. No, friends, a more humble question is, what has enabled me to be a productive, educated adult and not know more about racism? Like, how have I managed not to know when the information is everywhere and has been so consistently? What's with my plank? And we do this with God, too. We can tell others exactly how they see God incorrectly and how their thinking or their behavior goes against God's word. But me? Oh, my view on God? Yeah, it's pretty clear. This is why the well-known Jewish rabbi David Wolpe writes in his book, Why Faith Matters, about the need to pay more attention to our own biases and limitations and planks than the specks of others. He says, when people ask about God, I always say, quote, "When you were 2 years old, could you understand a 14-year-old? Of course not. And when you were 2 years old, it's not just that you didn't understand a 14-year-old, you didn't even understand what it is that you didn't understand. You're that far away. A 2-year-old does not know. I'm missing out on adolescence." He goes on, "And the difference between God, whatever God is, and humans is much greater than the difference between a 2-year-old and a 14-year-old. So, Rabbi Wolpe writes, being humble in the face of the grandeur of everything around us is the smart, natural position we should all take. And TNC, I'm just saying that when we talk about God or politics or human rights, we must take the plank out of our own eye. In other words, how about this? Before you share with me my speck, will you please tell me about your plank? What are the planks in my eyes? And this is really important to know because it allows me to grow. And it helps me give you grace to grow." Which is the third question. Question number 3. Am I giving you grace to grow? Because let me tell you a word that's really, really, really easy to say today. Gotcha! I gotcha! That was wrong. That was way over the top. You said something different 5 years ago, 5 months ago, 5 days ago. But friends, if we're going to ask people to grow and change, we have to allow people to grow and change. Hank Aaron was not born hitting 300, but he did end his career as a 305 hitter. Peyton Manning, threw 28 interceptions his first year in the NFL. Einstein got several equations wrong before E equals MC squared. The Apostle Paul was killing Christians before he became their greatest champion. And I'm just saying, friends, in this era we're living in, and our issues, by the way, aren't as simple as spending more time in a batting cage or behind an offensive line. In this era, when we're talking about novel, evolving viruses and social justice, and human beings from around the globe are having these conversations, we have to both demand change and then allow people, give them the grace to change. Because evolving and changing one's views or behaviors, it's not a weakness, it's a strength. Which leads to question number four, the fourth question to ask ourselves in this era. Here it is. Is what I'm about to say, or type, or retweet, or post, is what I'm about to say creating an environment for mutual love and growth to take place? I'm just wondering, in the moments before you say or post that, in your gut, do you actually believe that the people listening will feel loved and heard and understood and cared for and invited into an environment where more questions and more understanding are welcome? And by the way, I'm not saying that that only means warm, fuzzy conversations, because we need robust intellectual dialogue. But what I'm saying, to quote former USC professor and prolific spiritual author Dallas Willard in his book, The Allure of Gentleness, quote, "If we are seeking to defend our ideas in the manner of Jesus, then it is not fitting to engage in debates and arguments with an antagonizing, arrogant spirit. The best way to make the intellectual aspects of our arguments more effective," it's a good strategy, he's saying, "the best way to make the intellectual aspects of our arguments more effective is to combine them with a gentle spirit and a kind presentation." Sounds kind of like the Apostle Paul, doesn't it? Who wrote 1 Corinthians 13, "If I speak in the languages of great men or divine angels, but do not have love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but I don't have love, I'm nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor, and I give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing." Friends, is what you're about to say, or type, or retweet, or post, will it create a conversation where growth and understanding and mutual love and dignity will win? Which leads to my final question, because you don't have to agree with what I'm saying, or with what Dallas Willard is saying, or with what the Apostle Paul is saying. You really don't. Final question, question number five. Who are you listening to? Who are you choosing to trust? Who are you listening to? I remember in graduate school, the day I raised my hand, quoting to my professor something from a book I was reading. And he responded, "Ah, interesting, David. Who's the author?" And on the spot, I couldn't remember. And he paused, and it got quiet. And I was sitting in a class with maybe a dozen other grad students, and he walked over to my desk, looked me straight in the eye, and said, "Don't ever quote to me something that you don't know where it came from." And that was like 24 years ago, and I remember it like it was yesterday. And he went on to say to the whole class, "Class, you need to know in life why you are choosing to trust that author. Why that news source, that radio personality? Do you know where they were born? Where they were educated? Who or what were major influences on them? Do you know what their biases might be? Are you paying attention to how they speak and how they handle their personal lives, their money, their relationships, their power? Why are you listening to who you're listening to? Who are you listening to?" I think one of Jesus' best, most penetrating and profound questions is one he asked just before his final journey into Jerusalem in the final days of his life. He gathers his disciples around him in the region of Caesarea Philippi, and in a poignant moment, he asks them, Matthew chapter 16, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they reply, "Well, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah. Then there are those who say Jeremiah or one of the other prophets." And Jesus responds, I think after a kind of long and maybe a loud silence, in which maybe Jesus looks into the eyes of each disciple, walks over to them, before finally landing on Simon Peter. "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answers, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And within a week, Jesus will be accused, tried, and crucified, which makes his question all the more fascinating because you might suspect he would have been wiser to ask, "Do you all know what to do after I'm gone?" Or, "Listen, disciples, would you like a few more tips from me before I go to the cross next week?" Or, "Hey guys, do you remember the big three ideas we've talked about over the last 3 years?" Nope. He knows he's gonna die, and he wants a revolution in human behavior. And he wants it to take root and to grow after he's gone from the physical world. And the most important thing is not what or when or why, it's who. Because if he's just another wise rabbi, then he's just one of many. And if he's just another failed messiah, then everyone will disperse soon and go back to fishing and tax collecting and farming and so on. But if they truly believe he is the Messiah, because Jesus is at a well in Samaria, and he asks a question, "Will you give me a drink?" And the Samaritan woman answers his questions with questions. "How can you ask me for a drink?" she says. And it starts a conversation. And at one point, Jesus says, "You know, when I asked, you gave me a drink of H2O. But if you knew who it was that was asking, you would have asked me for a drink." And the woman says, verse 12, "Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself?" And Jesus responds, "Everyone who drinks the water I give will never thirst again." And they talk some more, and the woman says, "I know Messiah is coming, and when he comes, he'll explain everything to us." And then Jesus responds, "I who speak to you am he." And friends, we are living in an era where we're thirsty for the best answers. And so many people are offering us their version of what will quench our thirst. Listen to me. Do this. Do that. But we need a source whose water will never run dry. We need a who is greater than death and who has strength to help us overcome our fears and who has wisdom for our worries. We need a who. Who are you listening to most in this era? I pray today that we would know the one who offers us living water in our day.